This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com. And as a special offer for the month of October, we are offering 50% off for all of our Thoughtbot podcast listeners. Just follow the link from the show notes and sign up today.
Giant robots smashing into other giant robots.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. My name is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here today with Brenda Storr. Hey, Brenda.
Hey, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So you have kind of a cool story, which is that you joined Thoughtbot as an apprentice originally.
Yes. And I got to spend a month in Boston, but I don't think we ever talked to each other. Or were you there? Were you on like a walkabout?
I think I was not there because I don't remember this happening.
I don't think anybody remembers, except for Connie, who was my mentor. It was March
2014. Oh, okay. No, so I probably was there, but I guess I just missed you somehow.
That's okay.
That's crazy. Well, anyway, we forgive each other for that, I'm sure.
Okay.
Yeah. But so you started as an apprentice and then you became a legit full web designer / front end developer.
Yes. All my previous jobs, I had either been a designer who dabbled in code or a developer who got to dabble in design. But just, you know, in that traditional structure, everything was organized where they were separate worlds. But I knew I had, you know, I had skills in both. So I was looking for something like Thoughtbot because I was like, this just makes so much sense. Like, why am I making these detailed PSDs when I could just do the code? And, you know, I can do both. Like, there has to be a place that's going to allow me to do both. And then it was right when I was looking for work, and it was when the New York office was opening here for Thoughtbot. And so the timing was perfect. And Trace, who was opening up the office here, found me and courted me. And here I am.
Once he gets his teeth in something, it's kind of, he's very tenacious. I can only imagine what it would be like, but intense would probably be on the list of adjectives.
Very flattering. He's awesome. It was also the first time, I think, where I had been courted for a job. So I think it was nice to be at that skill level where I was like, I'm not an entry level anymore. Like, people actually want me, and I don't have to, you know, beg for recruiters to actually look at my resume or.
Yeah. How awesome is that?
It's so nice. And now recruiters, I'm like, where were you? Where were you when I needed you 3 years ago? Now you want me.
Yeah, I am such a sucker. Like, if someone likes me, I almost can't help liking them back.
I don't think that's unique.
No, I don't think so either, but I am fully susceptible to whatever bias that is called.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, I'm curious. You started to touch on this, but I noticed you described yourself as a web designer and front-end developer.
Yeah.
As those are two different worlds. And I think maybe people have different definitions for these, but I'm curious like how you split those things in your head.
Well, what I think is interesting being a designer at Thoughtbot, because that's really what the role title is just designer. Mm. If you look at the LinkedIn profiles of everybody who's a designer at Thoughtbot, everybody says something different and hardly anybody says just designer. And some people say product designer. Other people will say designer and front end developer like I do. So for me, I think I do it just to be very clear, because it's important to me that I also code as well as design. And so I like to make that clear in how I put myself out to the world.
So when you say code, are you throwing that like JavaScript in there or?
I mean, like, CSS counts.
CSS counts.
CSS definitely counts. And I will argue that hard. But I mean, you know, HTML, CSS, SAS is what we mostly do at Thoughtbot as designers. But I think growing more and more, and especially here in New York office, I'm not sure about the other offices as far as I know. I think actually all of us are getting more and more interested in learning more and more JavaScript. I think also there's a lot of developers who are more interested in backend and don't really. I mean, JavaScript it can just do so much. It can do too much. It's like so much with so much, what is it, with so much power comes so much responsibility. Like, it's really easy to do it poorly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that a lot of people don't like it because of that, because they see it being used for evil too often. So I'm really interested in stepping up that, my skills in that too.
So are there people still, I mean, I guess I bet the answer is yes, but I'm surprised to hear that there are people who describe themselves as designers working for the web that wouldn't expect to have to do HTML and CSS. Like, they just stop at the, here's my Photoshop mock-up level.
I don't know. I think that still happens. I mean, I haven't looked for work now for like a year and a half since I've been at Thoughtbot, or a little over a year and a half. But at that time, the last time I was really looking for work was maybe 2-3 years ago. And that, and the segregation was still very real. Developers were, I was choosing between two jobs. The job I had before Thoughtbot, I was working at a startup, and I had been out of work for like 4 months and I was dying. And on the same day, I got, within an hour, two job offers. And they were totally different. And so one was just a startup, employee number 8. I have no idea what I'm getting into. Mm-hmm. And the second was a large corporation working as a web designer, where the developers are in Seattle. And I would be here. And I just kind of, I think I'm going to be like an email designer. Like, I think that's what this job is probably going to be. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of like the big choice of which direction I was going to go with my life. Where's my path going to go? Am I going to have the comfort, the stock options, or am I going to try this thing? I have no idea where this could go. I think I made the right choice.
You went with the startup?
I went with startup. Yep.
Nice. How long did that last?
I was at the startup for a year and a half, and it was nothing I could ever expect. That's when before then I had just, done mostly web design as comps, and done a bit of, HTML and CSS just because I was interested in it. And a lot of times the developers I worked with weren't, so I would just kind of jump in and take over. Because they weren't doing it how I liked it. But this was the first time I'd ever worked in a back end, and it was a Ruby on Rails application, and it was the first time I'd ever worked with SaaS. And I was totally scared. I didn't think I would be able to really do any of the coding part. But my boss, CTO, Sarah Chips, she was like,
I know her a little bit.
Oh yeah. No, she's great. This is how you turn a designer into a developer, is you make it all sound like it's so obvious that they're not scared. Because that's basically what she did. Like, I never used Git before. And she's like, oh, it's easy. You just, here's what you do. And I just wrote it down. I'm like, okay. She's like, here's SAS. I'm like, what's SAS? She's like, oh, it's just like CSS. You just nest things. I'm like, okay. So nice. Everything was presented as if it wasn't a big deal.
Nice.
And so then I just kind of jumped in.
That's interesting. So that kind of runs counter to the way I do it sometimes, because I worry occasionally that if you give people the impression that something is easy and they have trouble with it, that they think the problem is them and not that the thing is hard.
Ooh.
You know?
That's a good point. I don't know. I think I also like was so fortunate to be in a really supportive environment where all of the developers, like it was very much like Thoughtbot, where every developer I worked with was super encouraging to each other, and you know that I was super new and they wanted me to learn, so I never feared asking questions, and I knew I didn't know everything was new, and I was excited to learn about it. So, but it was because everybody was so open to helping, and I was working with people who were teachers, who had been my former teachers, like Sarah Chips and Izzy Johnston, I was working with both of them, and they were both Girl Develop It instructors that I had, and that's how I met them, through taking Girl Develop It courses. So, so I think I was just kind of growing into this. We'd grown into that relationship where I was comfortable.
Is that where you kind of got your start with this? Was as a student of Girl Develop It?
Yeah, I mean, that's besides a few other classes at some place in New York called Noble Desktop. I took like a Dreamweaver class and a Flash class.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. And then I took some girl development classes, and I took kind of all the girl development classes because they were just so fun and the teachers were so good. And it was right when they opened. I think I was in like the second class ever. And I just showed up at everything they did. Like if they had a happy hour, I went. And then they started inviting me to things because I became like the best student, you know. I was like the Hermione Granger in my class. So then I just got to they started inviting me to hackathons, and then Sarah Chips hired me. So
fabulous.
Yeah, I was really lucky to meet really supportive and interesting, cool women who wanted to help me.
What a success story for that program.
Yeah, I know. And then last year I started teaching HTML and CSS with it too, which has been super rewarding. And I think I've learned more by teaching. I mean, this must be how it is for you. How like getting into the, you think you know something, and then you get into how to explain it, and you realize you have no idea actually how it works. Do you have similar experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the best test of actual knowledge in a thing is to go teach it to somebody else. It has a wonderful way of exposing the holes.
Oh yeah.
It's like, everyone, you know, quote unquote knows the thing, no one ever asks like, but like, why is it like that? Like, or does like, what about this? It's just kind of like everyone assumes a sort of base layer. But like when you have someone who's brand new to it, they can ask you these questions that just kind of come out of nowhere. And it's like, wow, I've never thought about where that might come from.
And I think that's also a challenge too, is having to, like when you teach, it's very easy to think that you're supposed to know all the answers. And if somebody asks you something, you need to say, oh, well, it's like this. I find it's really good to be like, oh, actually, I don't know. That's such a good question. Like, let's figure out how to figure it out together.
Yep. That like the watching the process of how you then go about figuring it out.
That's probably more educational. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things about I'm often trying to convince people to give like live coding presentations, and people are often really afraid of messing up, but messing up can actually be a really good thing. Like it can be actually really illuminating for people and educational. So like messing up is actually not really, it's uncomfortable, but it can provide like a really good educational opportunity for the audience.
Okay, so I'm giving my very first conference talk next month, or no, this month, it's October.
Congrats, that's awesome.
I'm live coding, like I'm going to manipulate code.
Mm-hmm. Great, that's awesome.
So any tips?
My high level tip for all speaking is all like my base tip is always to try to not be boring.
Okay.
Like the worst thing a talk can be is boring, because bored people tune out.
Yeah.
Like most people are sitting there with laptops or phones or the hallway track. And so if you don't manage to hold attention, you can't teach anything. It doesn't matter like how good your content is. If you can't get people interested in it, then that you won't be able to do any, you won't be able to change them at all. So I sort of always start from that base, which is like, how am I going to make sure that in these 20, 30, 40 minutes, I don't lose their interest? Like I'll program in things like, let's stand up and stretch, or like, let's take a break and do this weird focus game. Here's a GIF, or like, you know, like here, you know, check out this random thing, tell a random story. But I just sort of, I think of people as having about 8 minute attention spans and then needing something new. So like a new topic or a new stimulation or a break, or, you know, let's now turn and meet your neighbor. So that's kind of like always my base advice.
I'm using GIFs, animated GIFs. I think that's definitely key. And also you said something else about, one thing, like when I've given talks in, smaller, like in meetups, when the room is small, I like to keep it conversational and have people participate. And I am wondering how to do that in a larger room with 100 plus maybe people, if that's as manageable of an expectation, or how to.
I think you can do it. You just have to stick to your guns.
Sometimes let them take over.
Actually the opposite.
Okay.
What I usually find is if there's enough people, it's hard to wait long enough for questions. So you'll say, most speakers will say, does anyone have any questions? And then they'll wait a couple, like maybe 2 seconds, and they go, okay, and they keep moving on. Okay. And what I try to do is say, let's have some questions. And then I stand there and I wait for as long as it takes to get a question. And that can actually be really hard because it, as a speaker, you feel like you need to fill time. Like as soon as the mic goes hot and you're on the stage, you feel like if I'm not talking, I'm bombing.
And the sweat starts dripping from your forehead.
Yep. And so you have to really wait a lot longer than it feels normal and reasonable to wait for people. Because what's happening is they're thinking, do I have a question? I guess I could think of something. Oh, she did talk about that thing before. Like, how do I want to say that? Is anyone else going to ask this? Or should I guess I could, is there a microphone I should go? And like, all these thoughts are happening that take a little while to get through. And you're just up there going, oh God, please ask a question. Please ask a question. Please ask a question. But to everyone else, they're just kind of like sorting through their thoughts. So that's one trick is I think that recognize that reality that like your sense of time is distorted when you were up on stage.
That's really good. Both of the things you've told me are things that nobody else has told me yet.
Oh, nice.
Thank you.
Very cool. That's awesome. There's some talk I did where it was like a real battle of wills. Like I've never had it happen to this extent, but like, let's have some questions. And I just waited and I waited and I waited. And I was like, wow, this is taking a long time. And so just to make it really clear that I was like serious about like, I'm not proceeding until there's questions. I leaned up against the podium and just kind of like relaxed my body sort of thing. Like, I'm just going to hang out here until I get a question. And eventually the questions started coming and there actually were a lot of them once they started coming. But sometimes you kind of have to work for it a little bit.
Nice.
So just, yeah, don't be boring.
Okay.
That's the biggest one. That's what kills most talks for me is that it's clear to me the speaker has put a lot of thought into like the material they want you to take, like to learn. Like they put a lot of effort into their talk, but they haven't thought very much about how do you make the talk interesting. And that just like, you can see the audience tuning out. Like, remember, you're competing with the internet.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be more interesting than the internet. I have the internet right at my fingertips. So, like, you got to do better than that.
That's hard. I mean, the internet has everything.
Right. Exactly. But it does not have live, interesting things happening right in your face from another human. Right? Like, the internet can't, like, hop off the stage and walk down the aisle and talk right to you or, like, pull someone up on stage and do a live demonstration or start playing music and whatnot. Like, there's, like, a million things that you can do in person that are more stimulating than looking at my phone. But if you are droning on and you don't seem excited and you've been talking about the same thing for 20 minutes, that's getting harder to compete with.
Yeah. No, I get really excited.
Good.
I don't know. I bet this is going to happen, though. I'm going to get nervous because I don't really get nervous standing. Like, I get much more nervous in a one-on-one situation than I would, like, something about getting on stage. You're performing, and it doesn't have to be you. Or I don't know. There's something about it that, like, I don't get huge stage fright. I think I did theater growing up and dancing and, you know. I used to sing, too.
Nice.
So I'm looking forward to that. I think that's kind of why similar to you, I like to travel. I don't know. I was listening to your old Giant Robots where Chad interviewed you like a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
You were tired of traveling then.
Yeah.
What's happened since?
I still feel similar. I just don't love traveling alone, period. I'm like super extroverted. So it's not the traveling, it's just the alone. Like it's in a way it feels a little bit like a waste for me to travel when I'm by myself because so much of my enjoyment of new things is when I can share them with someone else. So like actually I've been figuring out ways around this a little bit. So I went I gave a talk in Bath in the UK.
Ooh,
earlier
I love
this year.
Bath. hits like the little like Jane Austen fan in me.
It was wonderful. Great conference. The Bath Ruby conference was spectacularly well organized, I would say. So kudos to Simon Starr and his team on that one. But for that conference, I brought my mom.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I was just like, hey, mom, I'm going to England. Do you want to come? And she was like, absolutely. And so we just turned it into like a mother-son trip, and it was wonderful.
Oh, my gosh. And like, I don't know. I think Bath feels like you're traveling back in time, and you just want to put on like Georgian dresses and take a turn around the pump room.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And eat cucumber sandwiches.
Yeah, absolutely. We snuck over to London too, so it was great, and that totally changed how that whole dynamic of that. So I've been turning down more and more conference-y things and being much more selective about it. But so now I just go to I go only when there are places that I really want to visit, and when I do, I try to bring somebody with me.
See, I just did in June. I did a week-long trip all by myself, and it was awesome. I hadn't really done that like. I had studied abroad in college years ago, and I did a little bit of solo travel then, But I hadn't really done anything since. And this was just, I just kind of had a week where I was in between projects and just made sense or something to do something. And I just wanted to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so I booked a trip to Scotland, and I'd never been.
Scotland's wonderful.
Oh, it was great. And I geeked out on whiskey unexpectedly. Nice. Like, I knew I liked it, but I sampled 30 whiskeys when I was there.
Wow.
Kept a list, went hiking in Skye. But like, I, being solo, I made sure I wanted to go to a country that was English speaking so I could talk to people and meet people.
Mm-hmm.
And I booked like a day long hike with a small group, but it actually ended up to be just me and a guide, because nobody else booked in the group that day.
Mm-hmm.
And had the best day, and he was awesome. It's Mountain Freedom in Scotland, if anybody wants to go on a hike on the Isle of Skye. Mm. And then I went to pubs and talked to people. What would you do when you're traveling by yourself to stay connected with people?
So one of the wonderful things about the Ruby community is how widespread it is. So there have been times where I would go to a place and just tweet and be like, hey, I'm in this place, who is around? And almost invariably would be able to connect with like three or four people, one of whom wanted to get dinner that evening or tell me where I should go for dinner and things like that. That's worked like pretty reliably.
Okay, that's good, because I am going, I don't know anybody very well. I have like some acquaintances in the community that I know at this mm-hmm. conference, but it's CSS DevConf, and it's on the Queen Mary in Long Beach.
No way.
Wait, do you know it?
No, that's, I mean, it's on a boat?
It's a boat. It's like that's a, so cool. It's an old, I think it's like Art Deco 30s decorated. It used to be a big cruise ship, but now it's like docked in Long Beach, and it's...
Permanently
hotel.
Docked?
Yeah, I think it's permanently docked.
Oh, interesting.
And I've heard they have a haunted house in October going on or something. I don't know. I'm pumped. Okay.
So you actually are from Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
How funny that you moved away from there to escape the tech world.
I totally did. I was,
and
like,
yet here you are.
It's like, I hate tech. Like, this is not me. These are not my people.
Uh-huh. Turns out it is you.
Turns out.
We are your people.
Like 10 years. Like 10 years avoiding tech in New York, and then getting back into it. I think mm-hmm. I also grew up without any, you know, like my mom was an elementary school teacher and my dad was a bus driver, mm-hmm. so they weren't into tech either.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of all around me, and I had friends who were hackers, but I didn't know what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also like the 80s, 90s, so it was before the internet, so it wasn't. There was nothing to draw me into it, and there were no courses in my high school around computer programming at that time. So it was just something that was all around me that I just didn't think I was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And then in college, my last year of college, I was a psychology major, mm-hmm. and I was graduating and was like, I have no idea what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I can do with this degree. And I had no idea what I was going to do. I knew I just had to move home because there was nothing else to do, and then figure out what to do next. And so I had a friend who was a computer science major who showed me how to like view source in, on a web page. Cause I was like, oh, maybe I'll learn to make web pages, cause that would be fun. And I was like, wow, this is so cool. And so then I made like GeoCities sites and stuff like my senior year in college, when I couldn't like sleep at night because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life.
Mm.
I just didn't even think about it as anything. And I just started temping and, you know, doing random jobs for 10 years before kind of getting into graphic design and moving back into web stuff.
Cool. So I have a designer question for you.
Ooh, okay.
So first, I empathize with our designers, because I feel like it can be tougher to defend your decisions like when clients are questioning them than as a developer. Like, I feel like everyone feels qualified to comment on the way the site looks or like where the button should go, where like an average client wouldn't say like, hey, Ben, like, I think this class might be too long.
Yeah. Or when you say, I think we should use this, they're like, great, I have no idea. Please
right.
just do what you think.
Right. but everyone's an expert on, you know, what color this thing should be.
Yeah, I think...
Does that ring true to you?
Oh, yeah, but I think that for me, especially, like, what design school was... And I went to design school after I graduated from college the first time. I went back to school 5 years later for communication design, and I did, like, a one-year intensive program.
You were all about education.
That's it. I've talked about all the education I've done so far.
Okay, all right. That's the end of it. That was not criticism. That was a positive.
And basically, all the classes were being critiqued all the time. So I think a lot by your students and by your teachers. So I think that, like, for me, and I think in probably a lot of designers would say, like, design school is more about learning how to accept criticism. Learning how to not take it personally, and learning how to dissect feedback in a way that is constructive for what the actual problem is that's trying to be solved. So I think, like, a lot of times clients will try and solve the problem for you. So when they say, hey, that button, let's move it over here.
Right.
They're trying to solve the design problem for you because they want to be helpful, and that's how they communicate. And so it's learning how to say, oh, well, you know, what, where do you think, why do you think the button would be down there? Like, is it not, is it too strong where it is? Is the placement not right because you don't think it's as important as it should be, that it should be lower on the page? So I think to answer your question, I would say mostly, like, don't take it personally, and then figure out what exactly the problem is.
The suggestion is
trying to solve the problem already.
Right.
And also, it's so great to say, well, let's ask users, you know?
Sure.
I think that's how, not to say you get out of everything, but that's how you get the answers to everything, is if, you know, client thinks A and you think B, and everybody's pretty sure that they're right, well, then let's go to C. Let's go to the users.
Yep. Or, like, run an A-B test or something. Yeah. So it sounds like one of my follow-up questions to that was, like, how to give good feedback then. And it sounds like it's more of talk about the problem, the core problem you think is there, or the goals you have for something, and that rather than suggesting explicit changes.
Yeah, but I think, too, we can't, like, I don't expect clients to be able, like, we all come from things differently, and I'm a very visual person, and maybe I'm working for a client that is not so visual, and the way that they're going to communicate is different than my style. And, you know, I think that's one of the cool things about being consultants, is that we get to work with a lot of different industries and a lot of different types of personalities and a lot of different types of people. And that's one of the big challenges, too, is, you know, if I'm on a project for 3 to 6 months, we will work on that together to figure out how to communicate and how to understand each other. And then it's over, and then you got to start again with somebody else.
Yeah, I try to do that thing of, like, identifying the core concern or, like, goal, and not be specific about, not be too specific, overly specific, I guess, about suggested changes, and kind of leave it open. Like, I try to treat the designers that work on Upcase, like, as, like, you are the professional when it comes to, like, interpreting the, like, what I want and into actual, you know, changes here. And so it's like, I would love it if this page felt more like a lesson plan, or, like, I would love it if the user had, you know, felt more compelled to click this next thing, and, like, and then kind of just, like, leave it at that. And, like, I know you're going to do a good job of figuring out how to interpret that into what's going to be on the page.
Well, you're a dream client then.
Oh, thank you. I've known a few designers in my day. we have an interesting thing that we can talk about.
Oh, what's that?
So you may have noticed, you listeners, that Brenda has been throwing me some questions a little bit, and this has been a little more dialogue-y than usual. And the reason for that is actually that Brenda is going to be hosting a couple Giant Robots episodes some point in the future.
I'm super excited.
Yeah, I'm excited for you to do it, too. A handful of random motivations, but one of them is that I've been doing this a long time. This is the 167th episode, and it's been over 3 years. Yeah. And it's been every week for quite a lot of time. And some weeks it's tough to get them out, I'll be honest with you. And Tom will be like, we got to get something out this week. And it's like, oh, man. And so having a little bit of extra help every so often is going to be nice. And I think Brenda's going to do an awesome job. And so this is kind of meet Brenda as guest and also meet Brenda as sometimes host. So welcome to the podcast in like a bunch of different ways.
Thank you. You know what? It's also really nice to talk to you because I don't think we've ever really talked before this.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Somehow we've never been on the same activities at in our summer summits or anything.
Exactly.
So, and you didn't even notice me in Boston.
Well, yeah. I mean, the not talking apparently happened in two directions. So.
Touché.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird working for a company that's big enough where this could have happened. You know, like we haven't had a conversation yet.
Yeah. Well, how long have you been with Thoughtbot?
It's been over 4 years now.
Okay. So how many employees were there when you started? It was only Boston or there was Stockholm?
It was only Boston. I think I was like number 15 or 16.
Oh, shoot. Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So now we're 86 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. And 10, 12 offices somewhere in there?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's big enough that, you know, we haven't chatted, but it is nice to talk to you finally for realsies.
For realsies.
In front of our closest 7,000 friends. Awesome. Do you have any questions for me about podcasting and hosting and things like that as I prepare you for this, groom you for your new position?
Ooh, I mean, I had asked you some things offline, but I guess... Mm-hmm.
Or things that are now occurring to you as you sit in the guest chair?
I guess just it's kind of overall for the, this might be a Tom question too, but maybe you know, Tom is the producer, right? Like how long do you go for? I would assume you talk for longer than probably the podcast length is going to be, and how much gets into the podcast and how much maybe doesn't. Do you feel like there's a good warming up time where maybe conversation isn't going and then it is, or what's
so Tom, Tom definitely cuts some, not everything makes it out. And he's pretty diligent about saying like he cuts out false starts and ums and awkward pauses and things like that. Like that one. I'm self-conscious about the ums. So yeah, so I think he says he cuts about 5 to 10 minutes per episode. So I usually shoot to get about 40 minutes of talking, and that results in roughly a 30-minute podcast, which is like about the commute length of most people, which is a pretty nice length in there somewhere. Sometimes I will interview somebody and we will have like a long digression on something that turns out to be kind of boring. And so afterwards, I'll just send Tom a little note and be like, that period we were talking about, the whatever, like maybe shorten that up if you can. And he does a nice job with that. So,
what podcasts do you listen to?
Ooh, what podcasts do I listen to? I like the Tim Ferriss podcast a lot. He has really interesting guests on, and I'm sort of like into that kind of lifestyle hacking, crazy life hacky thing.
What is it? I don't know what it is.
So Tim Ferriss wrote The 4-Hour Work Week and The 4-Hour Chef and The 4-Hour Whatnot, The 4-Hour Body. He's a blogger and author and things like that. And he has really interesting people on. Most recent guest was Scott Adams. Yeah, Scott Adams, the author of Dilbert.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, his thing is all about, he says, taking world-class performers and dissecting how they do what they do. So he asked them questions about like what their morning routines are and what are your habits, and picked up some interesting things from that. So that's a good one. Startups the Rest of Us is also good. Rob Walling and that other guy, his co-host. what else? Let me check. I've been really into Comedy Bang Bang recently. This is my like sort of guilty pleasure entertainment podcast, which is like an improv comedy show kind of thing, which is pretty fun. What else? Oh, actually Bike Shed too. I really like the Bike Shed, which is another Thoughtbot podcast.
I was listening to that. I was listening to the one about TurboLinks that when Derek was talking about TurboLinks, because that was the project I was on.
Ah, okay.
So I was really interested to hear all the very technical things that I didn't totally understand about the magic that he was working on to make this very, very slow app faster.
Yeah, Bike Shed is great. It's kind of like Giant Robots if it were way more technical and had better, more technical hosts that know how to program well still. So if you missed the way the Giant Robots used to be, which is sort of more focused on technical things, then Bike Shed would be a great thing for you to check out. And then my final podcast is the Savage Lovecast, which is Dan Savage's podcast. Do you know him?
Yes, but I haven't listened to it, and you're probably like the fifth person who has mentioned him.
Yeah, I have a big man crush on him. He's awesome.
Okay.
He's basically like, he's like a sex blogger
slash
podcaster, and the podcast is like a call-in show. people call him with their various relationship and sex issues, and he answers them on the air.
Okay.
In a very humorous and progressive and enlightened fashion, I would say.
See, I think I usually only listen to podcasts when I am on road trips. So being in New York City,
right?
I'm not always on road trips, but when I go back to California to see my family, my brother, my nieces and nephews live like about 4 hours from my mom, and it's the most boring drive in the world. It's I-5 from Santa Clara to Redding. It's just it's terribly boring, and it's also the same route I used to take to school and back when I was in school. So like I know it way too well.
Yeah.
And so I really love to zone out on podcasts with that. But I've been trying to figure out how to get it. Like, I don't take the subway. I can walk to work. So maybe I need to start listening to things when I walk to work.
Mm-hmm. That's when I listen to most of my podcasts. I walk to work, too.
Sometimes, maybe when I walk home. Because when I walk to work, it's like 9 a.m. and I'm walking through Midtown. I'm usually walking through Times Square. Mm-hmm. I know that probably sounds horrible. But actually, like at 9 a.m. in the morning, there's not much happening in Times Square, and it's kind of nice, and there's lots of sidewalk. But at night, when I'm walking home, I am never walking through Times Square
at
6 p.m., and that's probably the time of day where I really want to tune out what's going on in the city.
Well, podcasts are a nice way to build yourself a little protective bubble.
Yeah.
Full of information.
I'm going to try that.
Cool. Well, I think this is actually a pretty good place to stop.
Cool.
Yeah. So thank you for being on, and also thank you for helping carry the load in the future. And I can't wait to listen to your episodes.
Thank you, Ben, for a nice introduction and for a nice chat.
Yeah, totally. Cool. Today's show was produced and edited by the one and only Tom P. Obarski. If you'd like to access the show notes for this episode, you can go to giantrobots.fm/167. Thanks for listening.